conducting an oral history interview with Lois Warner Beer on October 25th, 1991. Lois is the daughter of Donald and Lois Scoville Warner, and she now lives in Fairport, New York. She is here visiting me for the day. Trying to make the machine work, so we'll stop and see how I'm doing. I am Mary Bodell, a classmate of Lois's at Vassar, and I have asked Lois to tell us in two parts, first of all about the Scoville side of her family, and after that, the Warner side of her family. She is a local person who's been raised in this town and knows a great deal about it.
Is it going? Okay. Although I now live in Fairport, New York, that is a strange connection to Salisbury, Connecticut, because in Salisbury, as a small child, I lived in what had once been Bushnell's Tavern. Then, when I got married and moved out to Western New York, I ended up in Fairport, which is very near Bushnell's Basin, which was for a couple of years the end of the Erie Canal until the builders of the canal could come up with a solution to how to build an aqueduct across a creek and continue westward. So Bushnell's Basin was where supplies and produce were loaded and unloaded, and the canal barges ended their trip from the east or started their return trip to the east. So from Bushnell's Basin back to olden times in Bushnell's Tavern, where I lived as a young child. I was a young child in the 1920s. My parents, Donald and Lois, had been lifetime natives of Salisbury. My mother's family, the Scovilles, had in earlier time lived in what is now the farm that is now Under Mountain Inn, and that was the family farm of my grandfather's family, Grandfather Scoville. His first name was Nathaniel. He had two brothers, Jonathan and Samuel, and three sisters, I believe. Nathaniel, my grandfather, was born earlier than my grandmother. He married her when she was a young woman in about 1870. Or 72. He had grown up on this farm in Salisbury, or outside of Salisbury, with his family. This was iron ore country. The Scoville farm was one of the locations of a small iron mine. Nathaniel and his brother Jonathan became very interested in the potential value of this iron. This was before the invention of the steel process, the Bessemer steel process. And therefore, in those days, back in the middle 19th century, hematite iron ore was considered of excellent quality. Well, how about doing something with that iron instead of farming the family farm? At some point when they were young men, two of these Scoville brothers, Nathaniel and Jonathan, started an iron ore business where they made iron castings. They had, as an example to observe, Barnum Richardson in Lime Rock, which did similar work. But they said to each other, these two brothers, we don't want to do this here. Let's go to Buffalo. That's where the action is. That's where all those little railroads are starting up that are going west. This was before the days of amalgamation into things like New York Central. So they went to Buffalo, where they started Scoville Manufacturing, and they made castings out of Salisbury pig, which was very good quality, and they made the castings for train wheels. It worked out very well. They became established and profit-making in Buffalo. In fact, Jonathan, at one point, was mayor of this blossoming city of Buffalo. At some point, my grandfather Nathaniel met Frances Wasson. She was a young woman from a Scotch-Irish family which had emigrated to the part of the country around Livingston County, south of Rochester, but not terribly far from Buffalo. Her father, Archibald Wasson, was a produce grower and dealer. He produced produce, and with his partner, John Butterfield, they carted produce to Rochester and Buffalo, to bigger markets than were available locally. They had eventually a little bit of business called Butterfield Wasson. My grandmother, as a young woman, was living a good deal of the time in Buffalo, although her father was sometimes on the road between the Genesee River Valley and Rochester and Buffalo. Nathaniel Scoville met my grandmother, Frances Wasson, at this era, and they became married. They probably, fairly soon after they were married, Nathaniel decided to establish his wife in New York City. Now, maybe he went back and forth to New York to pick up orders for car wheels from railroad companies, and maybe this worked out better than having her live in Buffalo. I'm not sure. But she was established in New York City before my mother was born. My mother was the youngest of her six children and was born in 1885 in New York City. My mother grew up as a young woman in New York, but with connections to Salisbury, Connecticut, that took the family back there at certain points in time, because there were still Scovilles in the Salisbury-Taconic area. Before I continue with the Scovilles, I would like to return for a moment to my grandmother, who was Frances Wasson Scoville. When grandmother was born, it was 1885, and she was born in Cuylerville, New York, near the Genesee River in western New York State. She once told me a little story relating to the death of Abraham Lincoln. Now, you have to go back and think that when Abraham Lincoln died, she was a young girl.
She wasn't born in 1885.
No, my grandmother was born in about 1855. Yes, my grandmother was born in 1855. When President Lincoln was assassinated, his body was taken from Washington to Springfield, Illinois for burial. Stops were made along the route to give people a chance to pay their last respects to their beloved leader. The funeral train arrived in Buffalo on April 27th. The body of Lincoln was placed in a special hearse made for the occasion and taken to James Hall on the south side of Eagle Street, west of Washington Street. The Union Continentals, a regiment from the Civil War, escorted the hearse. The body of the martyred president lay in state in the hall throughout the whole day and into the evening. During that time, thousands of citizens filed past the casket with bowed heads, many with tears in their eyes. At 10 o'clock that night, the body was replaced in the hearse, and attended by the guard of honor, it was taken back to the railroad station, and soon afterwards the funeral train left for Chicago. Well, I want to pass on a little piece of history relating to this and my grandmother. Grandma told me she went with her family to see Lincoln's train pass through Buffalo. When they were getting ready to go, her parents told her she should remove the red tassels from her high shoes and replace them with black tassels. Being then a little girl of 10, she really didn't want to do this, but probably went along with the request. Only this past year, when I read the previous account about the funeral train stopping in Buffalo and Lincoln's casket being removed and displayed, did it dawn on me the importance of Grandma being required to dress appropriately. Heretofore, I had only thought in terms of her probably standing by the railroad tracks somewhere and watching the train pass by and bowing or waving or whatever. Now I think it is much more likely that she and her parents went to view the body in Buffalo, and therefore you would have to be dressed appropriately if you were going to do that.
I love that story, Lois. You were so nice to tell me about it.
If you'd known my grandma, you would have really appreciated it too. Grandma was really a charmer, and I only wish I'd spent more time asking her to tell me little stories like this.
I wish I knew who they bought it from. Lois, I want to ask you now about the Bushnell Tavern, which was your home, your family's home, and where you lived during the 1920s and the 1930s. It would be a great help to the Oral History Committee if you could just tell us anything you choose to and anything you want to remember about the house. When my parents purchased the house, it stood out much nearer to the highway, probably very close to the one remaining large spruce tree. At the time when they bought the house, there were two, at least, trees there. They hired someone to put the house on rollers of some kind, and teams of horses pulled it back to its present foundation. The house may have been added to in earlier time, because when you went into the house, the levels of the floors all matched on the first floor, but if you went upstairs, the east third of the second story had a higher floor, and you had to go down a step or two to get to the western part of the second floor. That center of the second floor was the ballroom. It had an arched ceiling, and that room was long and not terribly wide and extended from front to rear. I don't know for sure, but I think it is quite possible that in its tavern days, there may have also been room for one or two overnight traveling guests. The house had three fireplaces on the ground floor, one in the living room on the west side, which went into the same chimney as a fireplace in the hallway. Those two were about, two fireplaces were probably 10 feet apart because there was a stair to the second floor that wound around them, around that chimney somehow. Then on the east end of the first floor in the dining room, there was another fireplace. This probably dated back to its days as a tavern too, before there was central heating and all that kind of luxury. The house had four bedrooms on the second floor, and additional, some finished, some less finished, little rooms on the third floor, one of which was my bedroom, and even that had a fireplace. When there were four of us children in the family, although it looked like a very large house accommodating many people, because my mother and father had some wonderful, almost second family domestic help, that reduced the amount of bedroom space available for, quote, us kids. And at that point in time, my mother and father built on the wing that extends to the rear of the house. And that became mostly our turf, with a living room where we could make a lot of noise and fool around with our friends and not interrupt my mother and father, who were great book readers in the evening, or who wanted to perhaps have friends of their own for dinner or to visit. The backyard of the house was wonderful because you could run down to the brook. You could even wade across the brook or over to the other side of the brook and wander up into the woods. It was really a fun place to live as far as outdoor life. You had lots of options, and we tried them all. There was even, if you went up the brook a ways, up in the woods, there was a small pond, and I remember my father taking me up there and teaching me how to fish when I was a young kid. And the first time some little fish ended up on my hook, I was so thrilled, I just yanked the pole and the line in, laid the pole down on the ground, and ran all the way back to the house to tell my mother I caught my first fish. And when I came back later, my father said, "How did you think for sure the fish was still going to be on the line?" Because I had never even thought about it. We also used to be able to walk up through the woods and connect with, quote, Uncle Phil and Aunt Mill Warner, my father's brother and his wife, who lived on the first back road off the road up to Selick Hill, the first road to the left, right before what used to be the, quote, cutlery handle factory, which hasn't existed for a year or three. Running back and forth through the woods to Aunt Mill and Uncle Phil's house was fun because Aunt Mill, when she married Phil, had two children, and they were more or less our age, and so we could get into a few more adventures with them. There were also, down the road, not far from us, there was Millie Fowler with her two adopted, probably, nephews, Art Jones and his brother.
And we used to fool around with them, too. We could sometimes get up a little tribe to play Wanacat in our backyard or somewhere, or meet up with them. It was probably a little different living on the main street then. I also went over to the library across the street, and I think I had read every book, every mystery story in the children's section by the time I grew up. I've probably taken out every book that was there. And Charlotte Norton was at that point the librarian. But that corner was a unique place where Fellkill, as my mother and father called it, was really a unique place. And the watering trough was right across the street on the corner, and people perhaps in that time frame stopped there to get water for convenience purposes more often maybe than they do nowadays. But there was the big stone basin there, and there was the cemetery behind the town hall, and we went over and investigated that, although I can't tell you who's living in the cemetery. And altogether, there were a lot of options of small town activities in that little corner area of the community.
How long would you say you actually lived in the community? For instance, when you got married and moved away, was that when you left, or had you left when you went to boarding school and college, Lois?
I think I came home for almost all vacations, holidays, until I finished college. And that was nice because I still had a few friends and relatives to come back and connect with besides my parents. And then I got married very soon after college, and after that I never really lived, quote, in Salisbury again, but I've never ceased to try to come back and renew my adventures there.
Tell us about your marriage. Where
did you marry at all? I was married in St. John's Church in September 43. My husband was from Rochester, New York. I had met him through my cousin Brett Smithers, part of the Warner clan. My husband and my cousin Brett had gone to college together, and we met that way, and we got married in St. John's Church by Henry Chiara. Unfortunately, some of our close friends and relatives were already gone in the service overseas or not able to come to the wedding. But I do remember there were a few who got there. And we got married in the church and had the reception at Fellkill. And it was a nice way to have it be. I can't imagine where else I would have wanted to get married at that point in my life, because I had never really, quote, been anywhere else. But then my husband was in the service, and we began living in other places.
Lois, that story about your being married and moving away sort of concludes your actually living here in Salisbury, but I wonder if you'd like to think of any other reminiscences you might have about your childhood there on the main street.
Well, if you think about it, when I was a child on Main Street, Salisbury, there were no, quote, paved roads. About the most elaborate and luxurious procedure that happened was annually they came and tarred the Main Street road. Well, for some reason, because I had been to visit my grandmother in New York and my aunties, and maybe I'd been to Hartford with my dad a couple times, I don't remember, but I had seen pavements. So I had seen guys having wonderful time on scooters. And one year, my mother said to me, "What would you like for your birthday?" And I said, "There's just one thing I want. It's a scooter." And my mother said, "What do you think you would do with a scooter? There aren't any sidewalks here." And I, being rather a stubborn little girl, said, "But that's the one thing I want." Well, my birthday came, and I could hardly wait to see what I was going to get. So when it came time to receive my presents, what do you think I got? I got a Cocker Spaniel puppy. But my mother said, "Well, you wanted a scooter. Here's a four-legged scooter." Then one time, my four-legged scooter named Windy found out that there was, at that point, a connection between the kindling box in the living room fireplace and the kindling box in the hall fireplace. And one time when he was not in good grace with the people in the house, he somehow wiggled his way into the wood box. And when we found out from a few squeaks that's where he was, hardly anybody wanted to crawl in there and rescue him. But he proved that there was some kind of a connection in those days between those two wood boxes, and he knew where it was. Oh.